Sweet. Okay.
Amy Carmichael, as you can see, very well known. Possibly you guys will know some of this stuff already, and I'm okay with that. It's going to, yeah. You will like this. You will learn something. Okay, so let's pray, and we'll get the show on the road. Okay. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us here, Lord, and Lord, I just want to thank you for your love, for how much you love us, God. You've blessed us so much. You're so, so good, Lord. And a lot of times we just take it for granted and carry on, Lord. I do all the time. And so we just want to stop and acknowledge you and in all your goodness and greatness in our lives and thank you for it. And just pray that you would be with us tonight, Lord. Whatever's going on in our minds and in our hearts, Lord, that you would just clear out any cobwebs, God, and just help us to be able to focus in on whatever it is that you want to speak to our hearts tonight, God, because we know you do want to speak to us all the time, God. Sometimes we just don't have the ears to hear. And so I just pray that we would just respond to you, receive from you tonight, and just be blessed by this life, Lord, that we're going to study. So we love you and commit our time to you, Jesus, in your name. Amen. Okay. So, Linda, so, obviously, we're looking at probably right up there with Gladys Aylward, a.k.a. Gladys Pip, the most famous female missionary in history, I think, Amy Carmichael, right? Pretty safe to say. Missionary to India. And I'd say she's probably the best-looking one we've looked at so far, right? We've seen some, well, a few words come to mind, but I'm not going to say them. So, I know. And she actually never got married. So, I mean, it's like, dang, I know. She held out. Not bad. All right. Amy Carmichael has been described as one of the most beloved missionaries of all time. Her own self-effacement and truly sweet, genuine personality has placed her in that rare category of too-good-to-be-true individuals. And another friend who knew her well said, Amy Wilson Carmichael was the most Christ-like character I've ever met. Her life was the most fragrant, the most joyfully sacrificial that I've ever known. And actually, in thinking of sacrifice, Amy herself said, this is one of her like kind of well-known quotes, she said, "You can give without loving, but you cannot love without giving." If you love, you sacrifice, you give. That's, you know, that's what love entails, right? And the married people say amen. Okay, so that's what you do, right? You give and you sacrifice to in order to truly love someone. And so it was actually said of Amy Carmichael that the love of God in her life was like a magnet, and it just drew people to her, as we're going to see throughout her life. And so I think that would be an appropriate characteristic to highlight. Chief characteristic for Amy Carmichael is love, right? Sorry, my phone, I just realized, is not on silent. One moment, please. I'm not good at multitasking. Okay. There we go. Was just telling me that the Mariners game was starting. So, yes, not that that matters, although this is so completely unrelated. But I was thinking today, I was in my office right before I came over here, and I was watching, I bought the Seattle Seahawks Super Bowl season DVD. So I was watching it in my office, and I decided that if Jesus had a football team, it would be the Seahawks, because here's why. They were all like the undrafted players, the players that nobody wanted, that were looked over. They have the first deaf player in NFL history on their team. I know, all the people, all the rejects, that's my team. And so I'm like, Lord, I know this would be the team you would have. And so I feel especially blessed. What?
That's not true. The huddle was created for a deaf quarterback.
Really?
No, that must have been college. This is pro.
Okay.
No, pro, sorry. Okay, I'm going to dig myself out. Man, he's good. Guess I shouldn't talk sports in front of your kids, Linda. So, all right, anyways. Yeah, I know, that was props to you, man. That's good. All right, so, yeah, I know. Let's go back to the spiritual part. I'm sorry. Okay. Not that one. You can give without loving, but you cannot love without giving. Is that what? Oh, whoops. Okay, yeah. I know. You cannot love without giving and sacrificing. So, write that down. That's Amy Carmichael's key characteristic. You actually see a lot, if you study her life, you see a lot of amazing, you know, qualities and aspects to her life. Her prayer life is remarkable. Her faith, her leadership, You can learn a lot of lessons from that. But all of that was really rooted in her love for God and love for others, her compassionate heart. And of course we know, right? Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, if I have all those other things, but I have not love, it profits me nothing. So that's the essential. So she was the firstborn into a wealthy family in Mill Isle, Northern Ireland. Okay, little Irish girl. December of 1867. And her parents were David and Catherine Carmichael. They were very much devoted to the Lord. And so they raised their kids to love and serve God as well with their whole heart. And so in her childhood, Amy was, she was pretty disciplined, pretty, you know, focused kid. She was taught never to give up when faced with difficulties. I think all the Irish are kind of that way anyway. They're just stubborn and feisty. And always to have unswerving obedience to the Lord. That was what she grew up knowing, that, you know, that was just ingrained in her from the time she was small. And like probably one of the most well-known stories from her childhood, which you guys might have heard, talks about when she was 3 years old. Her mom told her that God answers all our prayers. And so she's like, sweet, because she had brown eyes and she really wanted to have what she called smiling Irish blue eyes like the rest of her family had. And so she said, okay, God's going to answer my prayer. So she goes to bed that night, all excited and everything, gets up in the morning, runs to the mirror and looks, and lo and behold, she didn't have blue eyes. She could have gotten blue contacts, but this was the 1800s, so she didn't have that option. They were still brown, okay? Which I don't think is that bad because I have brown eyes and it hasn't hurt me, so. But anyway, she was super disappointed to see that her eyes were still brown, and so she went and told her mom, like, God didn't answer my prayer. And her mom said, well, you know what? No is still an answer, you know? It's not the answer you wanted, but it's an answer. And her mom told her, you know what? The Lord has given you brown eyes for a reason, Amy. And, you know, even though you don't see it right now, you will someday. And so she's 3, so she's like, whatever, you know, you don't care when you're that little. So she was skeptical, but years later when she was in India, as we're going to see, having brown eyes was very important. That would really serve her well in blending in with the people, right, and making them feel at home and comfortable with her, and for other reasons, which we shall get into in a little while. So Amy's mom was right. God did have a reason for her giving her brown eyes, and that's the same with, obviously, everything in our lives is for a purpose and a reason. And it's funny because I sometimes I'm like, should I even tell that story? Because it's just a silly little story. But so many people, I'm really surprised how many students have written about that. Like if I had like an essay test or something, a lot of people, for whatever reason, that really spoke to them. Like God cares about all those little details and he plans and purposes all of those things in our lives for a reason. So I thought that was kind of sweet. So like I said, Amy was focused. She was disciplined and, you know, determined and all that sort of thing. But she was, you know, she liked to have fun, and she could be very mischievous as well. She could be a little punk sometimes. She was the oldest, right, in her family, and I can't remember how many brothers and sisters she had. I'm sure you guys could find out on Wikipedia and tell me at some point. But, and she was also just a natural leader anyway, so she could get the kids to go do with the other kids and to go do whatever she wanted them to do. So one day she and her brothers, just to give you an idea what kind of kid she was, they were playing in the yard near a laburnum tree, whatever that is, and they'd been told those have poisonous seeds, so, you know, avoid them. And so Amy said, I know what we should do, you guys. Let's eat as many as we can and see how long it takes us to die. So they did. They all were like, yeah, they're chowing down these things. And they didn't die, obviously. There she is. She lived to tell about it. But they all got super sick and got sent to their room and got in trouble. So she did things like that. There was another story that I was just like, oh my gosh, that's exactly like The Sound of Music. They had this governess that got hired, and Amy didn't like her, so she conspired with all the other kids to just make life miserable for this woman until she finally quit and left and everything. And so, you know, she could be a punk. And there was this other story that I was like, whoa, that's kind of weird. For some reason, she had a frozen mouse. Okay, she had a frozen mouse in her pocket, and the mouse revived in the middle of dinner and started like going to turn to this whole big scene. But I'm just like, what kind of kid carries frozen mice around in their pocket? But this is how Amy Carmichael was. But then I was remembering what kind of a kid I was, and I was like, well, because my sister and I used to we'd stun flies with a fly swatter and pull their wings off and throw them in to feed our frogs. I know, I look back now and I'm like, that's kind of twisted, you know? Who goes and sadistically pulls wings off of flies and feeds them to their frogs? Well, it was really cool to watch the frogs eat them, so. Anyways, we'd also catch mice and then let them go so my dad could shoot them with the gun. We had an orchard. Okay, I grew up in Washington. It's a little different up there. We didn't go to the mall. So anyway, we shot vermin. That's how we roll. Okay. Anyways. I was chewing tobacco from the time I was 4. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. Ew, that's gross. All right, so obviously Amy was, you know, little fireball, little stinker. One time somebody told her how naughty she was, and she said, "If you only knew how much naughtier I could be, you wouldn't think I was naughty at all." She's like, "Oh man, you don't know the potential that's going on in here." So she was something else. She doesn't look like it in that picture, but in her little Victorian dress. So in spite of that, even though she was feisty and she was kind of naughty, she was also very sensitive to others and to the suffering of other people. She couldn't even stand seeing an injured or a suffering animal, which I think is where the mouse came from. I'm like, she obviously didn't stick it in deep freeze and then pull it out, and, you know, who would do that? So I probably, you know, they're in Northern Ireland, it's cold. Maybe the mouse was just lying frozen off on the side somewhere, and she, I don't know, felt bad for it and picked it up, hoping that it would revive, and it did. I thought that was amazing that the mouse even revived. Maybe that was a miracle or something. So anyway, so the needs of others obviously touched her heart. She, you know, even as a little girl, she didn't just care for animals. She cared for people, and she really, you know, she would go out and try to, you know, bring food to the poor and to the homeless. That's what their family did, and that was something she really had a heart for. One time, she saw this little girl in Belfast, gazing into a tea shop, and she was looking at all the cakes and all the sweets, and it was pouring rain, and this little girl standing outside in this raggedy little thin dress, obviously a poor kid who couldn't afford anything that was in that store. And Amy was so touched by this that she went home and she wrote this little poem. And it said, "When I grow up and money have, I know what I will do. I'll build a great big lovely place for little girls like you." And that's what she did later on, as we're going to see. So I thought that was kind of sweet. So even from the time she was a kid, you know, she had that heart of compassion. And so being the sensitive kid that she was, naturally, when she heard the story of Jesus and his crucifixion, that really struck a chord with her, even from a young age. In fact, the first time she heard the story of Jesus, you know, death and resurrection and everything, just hearing about the cross, she said she ran out into the garden and she tried to forget thoughts too dreadful. How could anyone hurt another person so, especially someone who was so good? And so this, I was kind of neat because I was thinking about this and just how, you know, her sensitive child's heart responded to that. Because I work with I serve with this program through the church called Release Time Christian Education, and we go into the schools of Santa Ana, the elementary schools. You know about that? Okay.
Years ago, I got
a... You did that?
I got memorized John 3:16 and got a ribbon.
Really? From one of those? Yeah. So, okay. So, Release Time. You've been going out and doing this for a long time. So, you go into all the schools in Santa Ana, and you do, like, basically a little lunchtime Bible class with the kids, you know, little fourth and fifth graders. And it was cool because this week I go on Tuesdays. And this Tuesday, we did, like, the whole, because we're getting up towards Easter and everything, so we did the crucifixion and stuff like that and talked about that. And just seeing the kids' expressions, you know, you're talking about these things, and we're so used to it as adults if we've grown up in the church for a while or been part of the church, you know, for a long time. You're just so used to hearing about it that it becomes kind of like, yeah, okay, right? And I mean, not like you actually really feel that way about Jesus, but you're just so used to it. But to see these kids hearing all this for the first time, you know, you're talking about, and I got really into the nitty-gritty there. I don't know if the other teacher wanted me to do that, but I was like, and then they put the nails through his wrists and all that, and they're all like, you know, just horrified by all of that. But it was really sweet because it was like really like hitting them. And I was like, man, Lord, I want to have that same kind of understanding of just like what you went through. And I don't know, it just brought it back fresh again to me. And I was thinking about that with Amy Carmichael here, because that's, you know, she was at that young age where she was impressionable, and how sweet to be that way, right? To still have that kind of childlike perspective of the whole thing. Because, you know, and I think of just of little kids, when they do hear about that, when they give their hearts to Jesus, that's a real work that God can do in their hearts, because that was what happened with Amy. You know, this was, you know, she was sensitive to that. It was like, wow, it really impacted her so much, even from the time she was little, that later on when she fully committed her life to the Lord at 16, it was just a real deep, a real sincere commitment to Jesus, because she'd had those seeds planted from the time she was small. So any of you who work with kids, you know, take heart. Like, that's a real important and impacting ministry. So Right. So from that moment, when she turned 16, or when she was 16, it says, from that moment on, Amy was transformed and began to grow and mature in her new Christian faith by leaps and bounds. More and more, she came to understand the meaning of the cross and the tremendous sacrifice Christ made for her and for all people. That spirit of sacrifice, epitomized in the Lord Jesus Christ, became the bulwark of her faith and her approach to Christian service. So again, it all comes back to what it comes back to every week, you guys. The way she knew her God, right?
Yes.
Right? The way she knew Jesus. Like it says, the more she came to understand the meaning of the cross and the sacrifice that Christ had made on her behalf, right? The way she came to understand and know Jesus and know his sacrifice translated into the way that she was going to live her life, right? Because the people who what?
Know
their God will be
strong.
And
do great things.
Great exploits. Close in NIV. That's okay. We'll let it go. All right. And carry out great exploits. That's right. The people who know their God. How you know God is how you're going to live. And so Jesus' great love and sacrifice, because Amy was coming to understand and know that, that was what empowered her to go out and love and sacrifice all for him. Right? If she hadn't known God in that way, she wouldn't have really been compelled to go and do that, right? It really is the way we're going to live, is the way that we come to know the Lord. So around this time, the Carmichael family moved to Belfast. They were out in the country in a quiet little village area, but they had to move into the city. And soon after that, in 1885, David Carmichael, Amy's dad, passed away kind of tragically. But Amy's faith, instead of, you know, getting bitter at the Lord, her faith got a lot deeper with the loss of her father, which is kind of what happened to Lilius Trotter, if you remember that story, which you probably don't, because that was, what, at least 4 weeks ago? That's as good as 10 years to you guys. What?
She got, like, obsessed with death and stuff, right?
Obsessed with death?
The Trotter, like, the reality?
No. David Brainerd. Very similar, you know. I mean, that's all right. Man, woman. I'm totally kidding, Corey. Okay. All right, so I'm sorry, my friend. So, soon after this, the Lord gave her a vision. She was out, and you guys might have heard this story before. She was out on like a, I can't remember what it was, like a Sunday after church kind of a thing, I think is when it was what it was. And so, you know, this is Victorian England, and, you know, everybody who is, you know, has any kind of social status or financial status, you kind of like keep to your little group and everything. So they're walking home from church, and there's this old beggar woman like dragging a load, and obviously she can't handle everything that she's trying to carry. And so Amy stops to help her carry her stuff. And so they're walking back the opposite way, and she sees all of these people, you know, from her social class looking at her like, what the heck do you think you're doing helping that woman? That's disgusting. Like, so she's all embarrassed and ashamed because she's, you know, doing what no respectable person would be doing. But as she wrote, this is what happened as she was helping this beggar woman. She said, just as we passed a fountain, this mighty phrase was suddenly flashed through the gray drizzle. Gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. And that's from 1 Corinthians 3:12. So that verse, like, boom, flashes into her mind, and she says, I said nothing to anyone, but I knew that something had happened that changed life's values. Nothing could ever matter again but things that were eternal. And so this was like a key moment in her life where the Lord was showing her, like, Amy, what really matters here? You know, does it really matter what all these people are thinking of you in this moment? You know, they're probably going to think about you for, what, 30 seconds anyway, and then go on to the next thing. Does this really matter what people think? Or do you care more about things that are going to last for eternity? And so she, from this moment, learned the importance of investing in the lives of others, you know, helping those in need, and how important that was, again, to lay up treasures in heaven and care more about what Jesus thought. And so, again, huge moment, turning point for her. Another big stepping stone in her walk with the Lord came about as a result of the Keswick Conventions, which I've mentioned before, I think in connection with Lilius Trotter as well. They had some cool little similarities, these two. So the first Keswick Convention she attended was in 1886. And Keswick really emphasized, and as I've told you guys already, leading a spirit-filled life, you know, a life of holiness, a life set apart to God. And it was real dynamic. It really brought a lot of dynamic back to the church of in England in the mid to late 1800s. So, yeah. Yes, he did. Not surprised. Yeah. I went there, like, was it last summer or the summer before? I didn't go to the convention, but we just went to Keswick to check it out and see what they had going on there and everything. It was kind of... I guess. Probably a little bit more, maybe a little Anglican. What do you know about it, Linda? Is it, yeah? No. The first one, mid-late 1800s. I don't know, 60s, 1860s, 1870s? Yeah, no, it's not that far in. Yeah, it has changed a lot. Yeah, they have a totally different, and it would probably make some of us kind of sad, so I think. So, yeah, unfortunately it has changed. But back then, this was when it was in its heyday. So, and it brought a lot of revival to the church in that day and age. And, you know, you think of the speakers that were there at Keswick, like I told you guys before, you know, D.L. Moody, Oswald Chambers, Hudson Taylor, you know, all the people that we read books about now or read books by them. Pretty amazing. I'm like, gosh, you know, it would have been nice to attend one of those. So they were very significant in Amy's life, of course, but as I've said before, lots of other Christian leaders and missionaries during that time period. It really, you know, as I've studied church history, I've been amazed at how many people were touched by the Keswick conventions, like how many people were affected by that ministry. So in Belfast, Amy really began to live out her commitment and her love for the Lord on a different level. She began to really start going out into, like, ministering, really. She started out just working with neighborhood kids. And I think that's awesome. You know, she wasn't trying to start with some high and mighty thing. She's just like, I'm going to just go work with these neighborhood kids. And so she started a little club, kind of like a vacation Bible school kind of thing. And she called it the Morning Watch. And so she just basically encouraged kids to read their Bibles and pray every day. You know, and she gathered them all in and they'd read their, you know, do a little Bible studies together and stuff. And even at this time, you know, and Amy's still pretty young here, but little kids of all ages, they were just so drawn to her. And she would go out to the most destitute areas of Belfast, the poorest areas, to try to grab kids to bring into her little Morning Watch studies. Again, you start seeing the love of God that was beginning to compel her out into ministering to those around her. So also because of their move to the city, the Lord opened doors for Amy to work at Belfast City Mission. And so as she ministered there, the Lord began to really focus her in on ministering to a specific group of young gals called the Shawleys. And that was because these were the young mill worker girls, okay, the girls who worked in the factories, right? And we've already talked about the Industrial Revolution and the factory workers and what a, you know, rough life that was. But these girls, obviously, they were, you know, this is, again, the Victorian era. Everybody wore hats, right, in society. All the women wore these big fancy hats and stuff. But these little mill worker girls, they obviously couldn't afford a hat, so they pretty much just put shawls on their head. That's why they called them the Shawleys. So it's kind of a derogatory term to describe the fact that they were low income, that they didn't have anything and stuff. So she began working with these girls more and more. And the Lord was started to bless it. The group began to grow. They got up to several hundred people. And then as she prayed in faith, the Lord provided a building. And that building essentially became the mill and factory workers branch of the YWCA. Remember, we've talked about the YMCA and the YWCA and how they were Christian organizations, right? They were ministry organizations. And so this was a branch of it for the mill worker and factory girls that Amy ran, basically, for the whole city. And she named it The Welcome. That's what she called it. So all this stuff's hit by here on the board. And above the platform, she put the words, that in all things he might have the preeminence. And that kind of became her life motto, right? That in all things he might have the preeminence. Very appropriate for her because she was always trying to deflect the glory off of herself onto the Lord, you know. She was always trying to bring honor to the Lord first and foremost. So the Welcome grew and thrived. They got to where they had activities going every day of the week for these girls. And Amy learned a lot of important leadership lessons during this season, obviously the most important of those being the power of prayer and faith, and really having confidence in God, that God could do anything. In fact, it was those key lessons that inspired her three basic principles. And I thought this was interesting. I just wanted to read these. These are actually her principles concerning fundraising, of all things. But I want to read them because I think these are good things to keep in mind in any aspect of ministry, really. First of all, she said, is the work for which we want the money God's chosen work for us or our chosen work for him? If it's the former, will he not see after the money that's necessary? But if it's the latter, how can we expect anything better than what we have? You know, if we're doing the work for the Lord and it's not something he's called us into, then we might as well just be okay with what we got. But if it's his chosen work for us, then we can expect him to do a great thing. Secondly, she said, how can we expect blessing to follow money given grudgingly? Therefore, they weren't out like pushing people and in fundraising and all that sort of thing, because she's like, we don't want people to give grudgingly. Obviously, God loves a cheerful giver, so you might as well keep it in your pocket otherwise. And then thirdly, she said, should we not see that our root, meaning Christ, is right before we expect to have flowers and fruit? Before we expect all of this other stuff to come, we want to make sure that we're rooted properly, right? And in all things, he might have the preeminence. And so, you know, it's no wonder the Lord blessed this, because he was always being placed at the center of everything they did, including, again, things pertaining to finances. So, a couple years into this, 1888, the Carmichaels were facing a lot of severe financial strain. It was hard, you know, back then to try to make ends meet without the man of the house, right? And dad had died and everything. So they were okay, but they were starting to really struggle, so they were forced to move down to England, which is an Irishman's worst nightmare, of course. So, well, I don't know. Maybe not everyone, but... Anyway, Amy tried to keep working in the city, you know, do inner city ministry as she had done in Belfast, but stress and illness started to weigh on her, and it forced her to give up the work, even though she loved it. She started to experience this real painful nerve disease called neuralgia. I don't even know if that's really is that something that still goes on today? I guess so. I was thinking, as I've heard about it, I thought, well, it sounds like when people get shingles, right? Where you just have like all this nerve sensitivity, you're in gnarly pain. One of the gals in the women's, BJ, you know, Linda, BJ's going through that right now, where she's like on ice packs like all day long. She's in so much pain because of shingles that she had 2 months ago. So anyway, it's kind of like that. So it's this nerve disease, and that started to flare up on her. And when that would happen, she'd be like bedridden, you know, for days and sometimes weeks. And so she realized she just couldn't really keep up anymore with that ministry. So by now it was 1890. It had been a couple years. And a friend that the Carmichaels had met through Keswick, a guy named Robert Wilson, came into the picture. Robert Wilson actually was the chairman for the first Keswick convention some years before this. And he, like I said, he became really close with the Carmichaels. He was actually known to the Carmichael kids as the dear old man. That's what they called him, the D-O-M. That was like their little nickname for him. And he really connected with Amy and really loved her like his own daughter. They just had a real special relationship. And so he invited her, you know, with all of her nerve issues, the neuralgia coming in and everything, he invited her to come and live with his family back in Ireland to see if that would help a little bit. And so he became basically like a second father to her, which is really sweet, you know, since her dad was gone, the Lord provided somebody else, you know, to kind of just step in. And so very, very sweet. So her time living with them did actually allow her to recover her health somewhat. So that was good. And it also exposed her to all kinds of ministries and different kinds of believers, all these people that were a part of the Keswick Convention. So it was kind of the Lord's leading. Well, kind of. It was definitely the Lord's leading, the whole experience, to bring her down there so that she would get exposed to all of this new stuff through Keswick and through Robert Wilson's influence. So it was during that season of life that the Lord began to impress on Amy the call to the mission field. In fact, it was actually after a message given by Hudson Taylor himself that Amy first began to consider a call to missions. And then finally, January of 1892, she was praying for the salvation of the lost, of those who'd never heard the gospel. You know, she's praying for those overseas. And she heard the words, "Go ye," repeated over and over to her. So I guess God spoke King James to her. So he's like, "Go ye." And it's like, okay. So she's hearing this over and over again. But in her mind, you know, this took some time for her to really surrender to, because missions wasn't really on her radar at all. Remember, she had a lot of health issues, and that was her number one reason for not even considering going on the mission field, was because she was in pain so much with the neuralgia. So she's just like, man, God, that's like number one reason why you probably aren't saying go ye to me. It's probably someone else. So, but it said, her biographer said, the conviction deepened more and more that she must go to the mission field to share the message of the Lord Jesus Christ. She did not find the will of God coming like a bolt of lightning, but rather just as a growing conviction. and yet she was utterly yielded to the Lord wherever he would lead her. And so it was such a strong burden over time that she finally realized, like, no, this is what you're calling me to do, Lord. And so she knew she needed to obey it. And I like this because what I like about her calling to the mission field is she didn't get that bolt of lightning. And sometimes that's what we expect when God's going to call us to do something or move on into the next season or whatever the case may be. And sometimes he does. I know, obviously, there are many stories of where the Lord will do that. But sometimes God's just moving on our hearts naturally, a growing conviction over time. You know, even in the lives of these great saints and missionaries, so often the Lord was just gradually moving on them, gradually growing their convictions, you know, to the point that, you know, they were ready to step out and do that. And that's good to know. It's okay if that happens, if you don't have like this flash in the sky. I remember when I went to serve with my family in England, that's how it was for me. I was thinking today, I was like, I don't think I ever had like a verse or like any kind of like major, you know, signpost. I just kind of started walking in that direction. Actually, at the time, Brian Broderson and Dave Shirley thought they wanted to send me to Brazil. And I was like, anyway, it was kind of out of left field. They're so funny. Like, well, you speak Spanish. I was like, dude, you guys, they speak Portuguese there. I was like, that's so irrelevant. Anyways, but you know, Dave's kind of like that. He's like, well, anyways. Okay, you know, you can go over the border. I'm like, well, what's the point of that then if I'm supposed to be in Brazil? So, good old Dave. Anyway, so they were thinking I'm going to go there. I knew that wasn't it. And I didn't have I never had like this flash, like you must go to England. And yet I just kind of walked in that direction. And the Lord just made it clear and put it on my heart more and more. And I got a heart for the people and all that sort of thing. But again, it was a process. And so that's, you know, that's how it is sometimes with us. If we're just loving and seeking the Lord, he'll put it on our heart, you know? I mean, it's gonna happen, and sometimes it's gonna be a gradual process. And so that's okay. You don't have to have all these crazy things. Although the Lord does work in that way as well. Yes.
I remember when Brian Broderson was talking about they were trying to figure out if they were supposed to go to England, and he said they were like back and forth. I'm like, how do we know if we're supposed to go? And then he said one day he looked up and there was a moving truck in front of him, and the moving company was CW England.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that's how he knew that he was supposed to go.
Yeah, it could be something silly like that. I mean, yeah, why not? Anyway, he does, absolutely. So, the hardest thing for Amy in leaving and going and becoming a missionary would be to leave her family, of course, and that would include Mr. Wilson, the dear old man. It was a sacrifice for her, but she was willing to do that, and the Lord really lovingly carried her through that whole process, and it was sweet because her family fully supported her, even though it would be difficult. So now, she knows she's going to go on the mission field, but she doesn't know where she's going to go, all right? She still doesn't have any idea where that might be. So she decided to do what most people did back then and go apply at the China Inland Mission. That's like the no-brainer. I guess we'll just go to China Inland Mission. I guess we'll just go to China like everybody else. But she didn't pass the medical exam. No surprise there. However, that same year, she attended the Keswick Convention, and she made such an impression on the leadership there that they decided they wanted to send Amy Carmichael out as their first missionary, their first Keswick missionary. And so, I know. So she was the first missionary sent out by Keswick. She later said that she was no more fit to be a Keswick missionary than a terrier puppy, so she felt completely inadequate. But when God closes one door, he opens another one, and that's what he did for her. And yet, it still wasn't until a whole year later that Amy realized the Lord wanted her to go to Japan, of all places, and really felt the confirmation from the Lord to go there. But that was a whole year later. So she's sitting around waiting like, okay, I'm supposed to be a missionary. You know, work with me here, God. And, you know, that would be a trying time. It's easy for me to just talk about that. It's like, oh, she went from this to this to this to this. But a year's kind of a long time to wait, really. If you have to wait for something for a year. I've been waiting for some things for, you know, certain things and praying for people and different things in my life for a long time, longer than that. And it's just, that's not easy to do, to wait for a whole year. But we shouldn't be surprised, obviously, if those kind of things happen in our lives from time to time. Even if it's like we know we're supposed to be somewhere, or we're supposed to do something, or we know, or we've had a promise from the Lord that a certain thing, whatever it is, might happen at some point in our lives. But we don't see anything immediately in front of us. There's not a clear opportunity. There's no results. There's nothing coming together. And so this is where, and I've probably talked about this before, where we have to kind of bring ourselves out from under our culture and the mindset that we have in our culture, which is instant gratification, right? This is how we live in a very instantly gratifying society. And we don't want to bring that into our relationship with the Lord, you know, whether it is our prayers, our service to the Lord, our calling and direction in life. So often we put time limits on the Lord, right? Without even realizing it sometimes. You might think like, well, man, I've been praying about this for like a whole week now or a whole month. God still isn't answering. Or, you know, I remember a lot of Bible college students doing this where they'd leave Bible college and they'd go get a job, you know. They're like, man, I've been working at Starbucks for 6 months and I should be in full-time ministry right now, you know. And I'm sure some of the school of ministry guys struggle with this too when they leave school of ministry. It's like, I should be doing full-time, like, this is what I should be doing. So, Lord, why aren't you bringing all this together? Or we go through a trial and we think, am I in sin? Why is this not going away when I pray about it? And so you start thinking, well, maybe prayer doesn't work, or, you know, you can just go through all of these head trips. But again, this is where faith comes in. You know, how much are we ever going to learn to trust God if everything happens for us in our way and our timing? And usually it would be worse if it went in our way and our timing anyway. There's that saying, right? Faith isn't faith until it's tested. And so, that always challenges me to just really persevere in seeking God. And a verse I really love is James 1, I don't know which one it is. It's the one that says, let patience have its perfect work. And I remember the time when that really, like, hit home to me. The operative word there is let, right? Let patience have its perfect work. We don't want to let anything happen, right? We want to just, like, go get it done and make it happen. But to allow patience to have its work in our lives, to allow it to do what it needs to do, to allow the Lord to do what he needs to do in our lives, it's so critical. And we keep, you know, in the meantime, keeping our eyes on Jesus, we know he will get us to our destination. He will show us what's next when it's that right moment. So that's what God did for her. Eventually, March of 1893, she finally knew where she was going. She sailed off for Japan. And once she got there, she threw herself into the ministry, which is what she did everywhere she went. She just threw herself into it hardcore. And she really wanted to go out and evangelize right away, but she really struggled with the Japanese language. This was a really tough one for her for whatever reason. Her Japanese teacher and friend, Misaki-san, I think I put her up on the board because she was kind of an important figure in Amy's life. Misaki-san had to be very patient with Amy because she just could not get Japanese. She just jacked it up all the time. So in a letter back home, Amy said, I shall never, never, never learn Japanese. You may put it on my tombstone, expired in despair. I wanted to say, I like fine weather better than wet weather. Not a complicated expression, one would imagine. But the twist of construction staggers me into saying, rain of coming down, bad honorable weather than even good honorable weather of days of side good is. So that's the kind of sentence she would come up with. She just could not get the construction of it. So, yeah, that was Amy's experience with Japanese. But the Lord did use her to make an impact, even though she had some hurdles to go over. Because even though her language skills were weak, her love for people was so compelling. And the genuine care that she had for them. That, you know, that spoke louder. That spoke louder than her lack and her weaknesses. And it's true. Love does speak the loudest, right? I think we all know that. And I was actually thinking of a friend of mine. He's an assistant pastor to a pretty well-known pastor, a guy who's like really dynamic and everything, but his assistant isn't quite that way. And I remember him getting up to teach and I was just like, oh wow, okay, that was, you know, thank you for, you know, it was sweet. But you know what, that guy, man, he loves people so much. He makes such an impact, almost an even deeper impact than just like some eloquent speaker would, because he really cares. You know, the love that he has and the care that he has for the flock speaks so much more than any eloquence. So who cares if he's not the greatest teacher in the world, you know? He's got that pastor's heart, and the Lord uses him in that way, and it's really, really sweet to see. So, anyways, back to Amy's love, not my friend. But Amy's heart during that time, I think, as she was learning how to love people and love and allowing that love to kind of overcome the obstacles that she faced, you could see that in this poem that she wrote later on, and this is one of her, you know, well-known ones. This is a little one. Oh, for a passionate passion for souls. Oh, for a pity that yearns. Oh, for the love that loves unto death. Oh, for the fire that burns. And I'm going to read a lot of her stuff tonight, so get used to it. Well, not lots, but some. Just give you a little taste, because she did a lot of writing. So, one key thing that Amy did was to adopt Japanese dress, and we've seen that, right, with Hudson Taylor and so many others, that when these missionaries made their biggest impact was when they identified with the people as much as possible. But for Amy, she actually had to learn a hard lesson before she saw the value of this, like saw why it was important for her to you know, be on their level or in their, you know, in their culture. Misaki-san had actually suggested to Amy that she wear a kimono, right? One of those little Japanese robes. But the weather was pretty cold, and remember, Amy has neuralgia, right? And it would flare up big time whenever the weather was cold, and whenever she got too cold, she's like, man, I just can't do that. If I'm going to be able to function as a person, I can't, you know, I have to wear my Western clothes. I can't wear some Japanese robe and have the draft coming in all the time. Woo! So that wasn't going to work for her. So she decided to just stick with her European clothes and everything. So one day, they were out evangelizing in the village, and Amy's sharing the gospel with this old woman who was very interested in what Amy had to say. And Amy was about to ask her, so, you know, she gets to the point where Amy's, like, getting ready to ask her, do you want to give your life to Jesus and turn from your sin and all this stuff? And all of a sudden, of course, right before she's ready to, you know, hit it home, this woman looks at Amy's gloves and sees these fur-lined gloves that Amy had, and she's like, oh! She gets all excited about Amy's gloves and all distracted because she's like, oh, can I try those on and all this stuff? And the woman got so sidetracked that Amy never was able to get her to focus back in on the gospel and the whole point of her being there. And so after that, it led her to say never again would she risk so much for so little. She's like, gosh, it's just not worth it. If I'm going to, like, if souls are going to be, not be saved, or people are going to be distracted from the message because of the way I dress, then I can't do that. I need to let that go. And so, with people's souls on the line, really, you know, comforts, material possessions fade in importance. And I think that's exactly what Amy was realizing. And so she went right home, as I'm sure you can guess, and put a kimono on every time she went out to do evangelism from that point on. And she didn't, you know, she'd wear her European clothes around the house and stuff like that. If she was just going out to the market or whatever, she would dress normally. She didn't go extreme because she knew she had health issues. But whenever she was going to go out evangelizing, she's like, I'm going to just have to suck it up. For the sake of the gospel here. And the Lord blessed it. So, let's see. We'll do this story and then we'll... Yeah, okay, perfect. Okay, so... another thing that Amy had been growing in and back home in Belfast and when they were living in England and everything else and in her ministry, as we've seen, was learning to step out in faith through prayer. You know, she'd pray and just believe the Lord to work according to her prayers. And the Lord continued to build on this in Japan as she started taking these little evangelism trips. And there was this one village that she ministered to in pretty regularly called Hiros. I put it up there because this was kind of a neat little season in her life, in her ministry in Japan. So what happened was she made several visits to this village. And on the first visit, as all the missionaries gathered to pray, you know, before they went out, before they launched out on this missionary visit, Amy felt impressed by the Lord, you know, just the Lord impressed on her heart that she should pray in faith for one person to be saved on the trip. She's like, okay, I can do that. Sweet. So she's like, Lord, I just believe you want to save someone on this evangelism trip, so, you know, go for it. So sure enough, they go to the village, and this young silk weaver hears the gospel and gets saved. So she's like, sweet, the Lord answered that prayer. So the second time they're getting ready to go to the village, she felt, the Lord impress on her heart to ask for two souls to be saved. And so she's like, okay, let's do that. So Lord, you know, you want to save two people. That's, you know, we believe that. We're looking forward to what you're going to do. And so sure enough, the silk weaver brought two friends that day, and they gave their lives to the Lord. So she's seeing neat little answers to prayer. So the third trip, Amy felt impressed to ask for four souls to be saved. Now this, you know, doesn't sound like a lot to us. It's like, okay, four people, but you know, in Japan, it was a pretty hard road. I mean, we're going to talk more about ministry to Japan next week. But that wasn't, you know, that was, honestly, for some missionaries, that was more people than they led to Christ in a whole year. You know, they'd be lucky to get see one or two people come to Christ. So to see four people come to Christ on one trip to a village was like, whoa, okay, that's kind of a big deal. But she believed God's going to do it. So they go there, they go to the village, they have their little, you know, outreach, and then they have a meeting. And it just was like going nowhere. The people weren't paying attention. Amy was really starting to get discouraged, like, man, Lord, did I hear from you? And so, and then all of a sudden, like, it was just like something switched. And so the Holy Spirit started to work. And by the end of the night, three people had gotten saved. But she's like, man, Lord, I thought, you know, I thought you said four. Do I not know my math? Gosh, I just, you know, maybe I just heard that wrong, you know, calculating and everything. No, there were only three. So she's like, so she was really discouraged. Like, man, I guess I didn't really hear. I mean, she shouldn't have been discouraged because three people got saved, but she was still a little confused about the whole thing. And so she goes back to where they were staying that night. And sure enough, this is just like God. He's so cute. He does these kinds of things. So the next morning, they're getting ready to leave. And you know, they're actually, I don't even know if they were up yet. Like 5 a.m., they hear a knock on the door. And wouldn't you know it, that young silk weaver's like, hey, I told my mom about Jesus, and she wants to accept Christ. Help me do this. And so that was the fourth person, was the morning right before they left and went back. So kind of neat how the Lord did that. So Amy got sick with neuralgia for a while, and she couldn't go back to Heros for quite some time. But before her fourth visit, she felt strongly that the Lord wanted her to ask for 8 souls to be saved. Now remember, the other missionaries, you know, they've all been praying with her up to this point. And they're like, okay, Amy, yeah, we'll see. Yeah, wow, look what the Lord did. But when she said that the Lord wanted 8 people to be saved, they're like, oh, honey, you know, you're young. You're just starting to get real kind of crazy here, you know, getting a little too overzealous. And so they felt like this wasn't an act of faith anymore, that she was being presumptuous. And they said, why don't we just pray for a blessing? Just pray that God will just bless. And it's like, oh, that's so lame and vague. And so she was getting kind of frustrated. And she insisted, she's like, no, you guys, I really believe this. I'm not trying to do some crazy thing here. I'm not trying to bring glory to myself or anything like that. And so it was sweet. One of the older missionary guys reminded everyone. He said, you know what? Like it says in Jeremiah, nothing's too hard for the Lord. Let's go ahead and pray with her and just see what the Lord might do. And sure enough, 8 people got saved on that trip. So, and that was the end of her ministry in Heros. She didn't actually end up going back there anymore. But it was just this little season where she was going and seeing the Lord answer these specific prayers, because he would do that later on. When she went to India, she'd start to see that happen again. Remember with Hudson Taylor, right? How the Lord was building his faith, right, early on for other things in the future. Same thing with Amy, right? He's building her faith in these instances for other things that would follow. Amy spent 15 months in Japan. That was all that she spent there. It was like a little over a year, surprisingly. It sounds like she spent a longer time, but she was only there for 15 months. She grew a lot. She was stretched. You know, she was getting prepared, as I said, for future ministry. But the neuralgia was really starting to get bad and really flaring up worse and worse. And so leaving Japan was very, very hard for Amy, but she had to get to a better climate. So take a break now, and we'll get to that better climate after the break. We'll go early because I think I kind of started on time for once. So, yes.
Yeah,
27, 6?
26, 27. Oh, yeah, because she turned 27 back home.
Let's do this. I can't write fast enough to put down everything. I should slow down, especially if we're going to... we're going to get done early. Okay. Ready? Mm-hmm. Let's do this. What? Why are you answering? Take a phone call right now? Seriously? Sosie, what are you doing, man? Okay.
Sosie, I love Sosie. Does he still have
the app? You do. Wow. All right. Anyways.
She left Japan because her
needs. Yes, to get to a better climate. Here we go. So, first of all. No, she went to Ceylon. Oh, you weren't expecting that one, huh? Nobody expects Ceylon. I don't either. I think that's where tea comes from, right? C-E-Y-L-O-N?
Oh, yes.
C-E-O-K. Isn't that an island? Help me here, people. I should have looked this up. I'm pretty sure it's an island. Oh, yep. Leave it to the... Wait, how old are you? 12?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. But you were so confident, and you knew that other thing about huddling and the deaf people and stuff, so... Anyway, I don't know. I'll believe everything you say from now on. Okay. You can come teach. Oh, really? Wait, what, 14? 12? 15? You're 15? I'm so sorry. I always think of Esther as 15 because you were 15, what, 4 years ago? 3 years ago? She's 18. See? Okay. I'm thinking of you guys as the age I met you. How's that? Does that redeem it? Okay. Here we go. Are you ready? Lydia and Corey, of course you're ready. Yay! Okay. So, she goes to Ceylon because there's a better climate there.
That's in India?
and near India, right? Isn't it an island? Oh, it's an island, right? Thank you. If you were, why weren't you there to bail me out earlier? Now known as Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
Oh, I should know that. I have a friend from Sri Lanka. Gosh, I'm a nerd. I didn't realize it used to be called Ceylon. Silly me. Okay. So. Ah, it was their fault. Okay. I like Sri Lanka better. Hmm? Yes, Myanmar. Judson, Adoniram Judson. You mixed them. That was smooth, though, Linda. I mean, I was totally with you. Okay. You can mix up all the names. I'm like, yeah, totally. Okay. So she began to feel like the Lord was calling her to India. She read this letter from a friend about what India was like, and she started thinking, well, maybe this is what the Lord wants. But then the dear old man, Robert Wilson, had a stroke, so she had to go back home to Ireland first, back to the UK. So she spent Christmas 1894 there, celebrated her 27th birthday, stayed in the UK for the majority of the following year, and then October of 1895, she sailed for India. Okay. So her first year was basically spent in language study, which was obviously Amy's favorite thing to do in the world. 1895. Sorry. I said that so fast. You might have missed it because you were on the phone, so. I'm just kidding. All right, so. I'm sorry. I know. Anyway. Watch it, Corey. I'll go after you again. All right. Oh, that makes me sad. All right. So she's learning language, learning Indian customs and culture. You know, major gear change after Japan, so she had to adapt to a whole new way of living and everything. So this was an important time of training, but for Amy, these were always very frustrating and difficult times for her. She never really did well. She had a really hard time being patient through those seasons of training. The stuff that seemed frustrating, the stuff that seemed pointless, she had a real hard time with that. But none of it was wasted. It was all very significant, and I think later she would realize that and admit it. So she was, but in the meantime, she was struggling, not just with learning the language, but she, you know, she had a pretty good connection with some of the missionaries in Japan. But here in India, at first, she felt very alone. She had a different vision than some of the other missionaries had. And back when she'd been in Japan, she was in conversation once with a missionary who made some kind of shocking comment. I think it must have been some kind of like malicious comment about another missionary or something. And Amy was really surprised, like, whoa, I can't believe you just said that about them. But the lady said to Amy, she said, what, you think missionaries love each other? All love each other? And she's like, well, yeah, I guess I'm an idiot for thinking that. My bad. You know, she really was stunned by that this woman would, you know, just think it was no big deal to just, you know, slander somebody and kind of carry on with the conversation. So she was disillusioned to find out that in Japan and in India, even missionaries did not always walk in love. They didn't always walk in unity. And so that gave her determination and resolve that she was not going to let that happen to her. She really wanted to pray that she would love in every circumstance and situation, whatever, you know, whatever it might be. Sometimes that's good. A good deterrent is seeing somebody else do something. You're like, whoa, I don't want to go down that road. Yes. Right? Yep. I remember when I was a kid, this is so random, this has nothing to do with it, but I just remember when I was in high school, somebody said randomly, like, oh, people in their 20s think they know everything. And so when I got in my 20s, seriously, I always remembered that. I was like, Lord, I don't ever want to be somebody who thinks I know everything because I'm in my 20s. And I still did sometimes, but it's kind of funny. It's kind of true. But anyways, you move on a little bit. But it's those kind of things that stick with you, like, I don't want that to happen. And so for Amy... Hey. Huh? Sorry?
Who were those two missionaries that went out to minister to the Native Americans and, like, they had to, like, separate? There was, like, so much. We learned about them early on.
Oh, yeah.
And then the one guy got slaughtered and his whole family, they got, like,
the Whitmans?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a gnarly story. Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks for bringing that up. Now I'm depressed. And their daughter drowned. And, yeah, I know. I'm just kidding. No, it's fine. Poor Corey. Can't say anything. It's just fun. You just, you know, set yourself up. Bump, set, spike. All right. So, you know I love you, right? Just like Amy Carmichael. I was learning to love. So, She prayed for love in every circumstance and situation. And now I'm sure she's struggling in India and she's learning to live this out. You know, she's remembering what that conversation with that missionary in Japan, and she's like, man, Lord, help me to love these people, even though I don't want, you know, I don't have, you know, anything in me that can do that. Of that time, she said, the hardest thing is to keep cheerful and loving under the little things that come from unpleasant surroundings, the very insignificance of which adds to their power to annoy, because they must be wrestled with and overcome. A disagreeable habit in another person must be accepted as a chance to die to self. So that's what we learn, right, from the difficult people in our lives, is a chance to die to self. And I love that, though. I think that's a great way to look at it. And so, I think that sums it up, because really, that is the truth. What? You guys are looking at each other? You're like, yeah, I'm going to die all day. All right. Anywho. But really, in all seriousness, a chance to die to self, that is what it really, what love really is, because love often is a choice. It really is a death to self. It's not always easy to embrace unless we see it as an opportunity. You know, and I love that about that statement where she said it was a chance to die. It was an opportunity to lay my life down, you know, for somebody else. A chance to die. And so, that's the thing too, whenever we do that, whenever we die, we're identifying with Jesus, whenever we choose to lay our life down in that way. And so, valuable lesson she was learning for the future. So, during this frustrating season, you know, the Lord was always very kind to her in this. He always provided somebody to come along during those hard struggle times of struggle. And she happened to meet this guy, Reverend and Mrs. Walker. I think his name was Iyer Walker. I never understood that was, I think that was his Indian name, but... I don't remember what his real name was, so I just put Reverend. Reverend and Mrs. Walker, they were missionaries who had 10 years of experience in India, and they really took Amy under their wing and you know, started helping her along and helping her transition. It was sweet to find some like-minded missionaries. They also really emphasized that she needed to learn the language. The language of that particular region that she was in was Tamil? Tamil?
Tamil.
Okay, thank you. And so they gave her a lot of important, just invaluable knowledge, wisdom, you know, really helped her grow in Christian maturity, and that helped Amy a lot for the future. And Reverend Walker wouldn't let Amy go out evangelizing until she learned enough of the language. And for her, she's like, I'll just do what I did in Japan, and I'll just go wing it and bring a translator and just get out there. He's like, no, you're not going to do that until you actually sit here and learn this language. And she's like, oh, you know, so that was a very frustrating thing for her, but she needed to do this. And it was a bummer at the time, but knowing the language, and of course adopting Indian dress and all that stuff, which she would do anyway, it really helped her to connect with the people later on. It really made all the difference. And I think later on she looked back on that and realized that he was right, even though it was frustrating that he would, you know, make her do these kinds of things. So eventually she was able to go out into the villages with the Walkers, and pretty soon she gathered this group of young converts to go do evangelism together. And she named them, and I thought this was really cheesy, but I'm like, well, she was a poet, and, you know, she liked to say, she named them the Starry Cluster for whatever reason, all these little, and it was a bunch of young female converts. They all got together and went out and ministered together. Everywhere they went, for whatever reason, Amy was always attracting kids. Crowds of kids would always come to her, right? Just like back home in Belfast, and back when she was in England, everywhere she went, little kids were always drawn to her. In fact, the Hindus started calling her the child-catching Missy Amal. And some of them actually believed that she had some kind of drug that she was giving the kids that they were coming back for. So it's just like, she's getting them high, and so they just keep coming back to her all the time. But we, of course, know that was not the case. It really was just the love of the Lord, right? The love of Jesus was drawing these kids to her. And they later said that. They were like, it was simply because she loved us. That's really what, that's all it was that drew us to her. So, in 1898, Amy had her first encounter with a temple prostitute, real tough woman, and the temple prostitutes, obviously, I'm sure you know, I mean, they had them way back in Bible times, right? So they were married to the gods, and so they spent their lives in service to the Hindu priests and the worshippers, you know, just, you know, obviously, for worshiping their gods through sex, basically, and so not a single one of these women had ever been converted. And of course, Amy, having that sensitive heart, was so broken by that. Like, wow, these women, they're just like there to just spend their life, you know, waste their lives on this, and you know, and none of them had ever, you know, given their hearts to the Lord. So she took that on as kind of a challenge, like, man, I want to find a way to reach these women. You know, again, the love of Christ constraining her to go and try to find a way. But she didn't know how. I mean, there was no, she had no door in, no way of really connecting, and she had nothing to connect with this woman on that she had met. And so she was just kind of stumped. So a whole year later, March of 1899, after that first little seed was planted in her heart and her mind concerning the prostitutes, this little 7-year-old temple child named Prina came into the picture. And Prina, again, she's 7 years old. Even though she was so young, she had been given to the temple to be trained up for prostitution. And obviously the thought of that terrified her when she figured out what was going on. When she was, you know, she's old enough to kind of get a vague idea that this isn't good. this is not a good future for me. And so she escaped the temple women and went looking for the child-catching Missy Amal that she had heard so much about, you know, from all the other kids. Everybody in the area by this time knew who Amy was, right? And so all the little kids knew. And so she'd heard about her, and she's like, oh, she loves kids. I'll go find her. So Prina escapes. She finds Amy at the home of the Walkers. And even though 6 temple women came hunting for Prina later on that day, Amy just gave them money, and they were totally fine with that. They were appeased. They never bothered her again. They were like, okay, sweet, bye. So you can have her. So that was the day that Amy became Ama for Prina, and that's the Tamil word for
mother.
There we go. So she became her mother that day. And right from the beginning, Prina told Amy in detail all about the life in the temple and what it was really like in there. So remember, Amy wanted a door in, and she had none, right, with the adult prostitute women. I mean, they were just like a wall. They didn't want, you know, they wanted nothing to do with her. And so here's this little kid who comes and gives her all the inside scoop as to what's going on in the temple, and talking about how little children are being exploited and forced into prostitution and stuff like that. And so Prina was really kind of really an instrument of God in revealing to Amy what was really going on here. And not just the fact that, you know, it wasn't just adults that were out, you know, prostituting themselves, but little kids were getting an early start in this whole wicked business, right? So Amy was just devastated by that. And so she determined that she was going to find out how the temple got these infants and kids. Like, where do they find these kids? Who are these kids that they take into temple service and train up in prostitution? Because she figured, you know, maybe we could find a way to, like, cut it off somehow, you know, if I could find a way to intervene, you know, ahead of time. You know, that was kind of her strategy here. But, you know, the whole thing was such a secretive business. You know, the whole Hindu religion had all of this intrigue and secretive stuff going on, and she couldn't really figure out what, you know, she just couldn't get any answers from anybody as to what was really going on. And a lot of people actually thought she was ridiculous for believing a little 7-year-old kid. It's like, kids tell stories all the time, Amy. You can't listen to everything they say. And, you know, she probably made half of that stuff up out of her imagination and all this sort of thing. So a lot of people downplayed the whole thing. So it took Amy 3 years before she could even start finding some information and learning about the realities of the whole issue. In fact, as she went around and asked different people, including missionaries, again, it seemed nobody knew anything, and for the most part, nobody even really cared. You know, they were just kind of like, you know, we don't need to go stirring things up in their culture. Let's just, you know, it is what it is, and, you know, let's just kind of do our thing, and we'll serve the Lord, but we're not going to go into that area. There's no point in doing that. And again, some people thought Amy was imagining things or being dumb for listening to Prina. Even the Indian Civil Service, she's like, okay, well, I'll go to the government. Maybe they'll do something. But they couldn't even prove anything. They're like, you know, we really don't have any, you know, eyewitness accounts of anything that's going on. We don't really know. So they couldn't even really prove the child abduction was going on. Because that's what she kind of was suspecting. Like, they must just abduct these kids or get them from some other, you know, means. I don't know how they do this. And so, but Amy, even though everybody else, like, pretty much anybody else that she turned to, kind of rejected the whole idea. She knew that this was a burden from the Lord, that this was something that God had, you know, opened her eyes to for a reason, and she needed to walk in that regardless of the opinions of others. And so she said, sometimes it was as if I saw the Lord Jesus Christ kneeling alone as he knelt long ago under the olive trees, and the only thing that one who cared could do was to go softly and kneel down beside him so that he would not be alone in his sorrow over the little children. So that was her picture of it. I was like, man, that's quite a picture, right? And here's Jesus. And she just felt like, you know, this is just a burden. This is just between you and me, Lord. Nobody else seems to understand or have a heart for this. So I'll go do this with you. So Amy was very driven to find the truth about the issue. And so she became a little detective. And so she started going and trying to piece together any information she could. She jokingly called herself Alice in Underland because she had to go hang out among all the lowlife and the riffraff of India. She was just really kind of underground to try to find clues, man. She's hanging out with all the, you know, I don't know, just all the shady people in India to try to figure out what was going on. She started to, like, really go hardcore on this, and she started to dye her face and hands with coffee so it would be darker so that she could go and, you know, mingle more freely and be very clearly not a Westerner, right? And so remember when she was 3 years old and she wanted to have blue eyes? It's a really good thing she didn't, right? Because having blue eyes would have been a dead giveaway, man. No matter how dark she made her skin, if she's out there, bing, you know, with her eyes would have just been so obviously, you know, distinct. And so because they were brown, she was completely hidden, really. And she could kind of, you know, just work her way into the system. She was able to gain access to the temples and see for herself exactly what they were doing, the rituals that they were doing with these little kids. And she found out it wasn't just little girls, it was little boys. So there's all of this exploitation going on, training them up for, you know, a life of, yeah, basically, yeah, sexual exploitation. And so in the end, she was able to expose this practice better than anybody else probably ever could, because she really went all out to find out, and she went in where nobody else was able to go or would have wanted to go and find out what was going on. So she eventually discovered that a lot of times, yeah, they would abduct kids, but oftentimes kids were actually donated to the temple and infants. And it was a very real thing, but it was carried out secretly for various reasons. One reason was sometimes parents would vow to give one of their children to the gods in order to get recovery from an illness. You know, if they were in desperate straits, they'd be like, okay, we'll just give one of our kids to the gods, and then, you know, it'll appease them and we'll be healed. Sometimes, I don't know if it was just depending on how devout you were in or whatever, but sometimes firstborn child was considered to be belonging to the gods, so they would give their firstborn kids. And a lot of times, and this would probably make sense, boys were considered preferable to girls, so a lot of times families would give their unwanted girls to the temple, you know, if they could get money out of it. So they would sell their little girls for that. And then a fourth reason that Amy discovered was that a lot of times widows or deserted wives would marry their kids to the gods also for economic reasons, because they're destitute. You know, they don't have a husband, anyone taking care of them, so they would just sell their kids in order to be able to survive. So it was a really dark, very ugly practice, and so no wonder it was a secret. Nobody, you know, it was kind of a shameful thing. Nobody wanted people to know that they had to sell their kids to the temple and stuff like that. So, yeah.
I wonder if the temple would accept the untouchable children.
That is a good question. Probably not. I wouldn't think so. The pariahs or whatever. Yeah, I don't think so. Like the outcasts, pariah, right? Isn't that what they're called? So they're the lowest of the lowest castes. They're the people that nobody, yeah, the untouchables are the lowest of the caste system. Yeah, that's probably the best way to explain it. So yeah, you don't, yeah, exactly. Which is why it was such a big deal for Hindus to become Christians, because you're completely breaking with the entire caste system, not just going from one caste to another. So that in and of itself was really bad. If you married into a lower caste, you were like, you know, whatever. Completely, yeah, or just, yeah, or completely, like, whatever the word is when you get cut off from your family.
Disowned.
Thank you. I was going to say excommunicated, but that's different. So, in 1903, Amy published a report about all the things that she discovered concerning child prostitution in a book called Things as They Are. This is an important book that she wrote, and she was very careful in this book to tell the truth. She didn't want to exaggerate or try to paint it all dramatically or anything like that, because she's like, I don't want to, you know, over-glamorize this thing or something, or sensationalize the whole issue. She was very careful about it, but even so, even though she didn't exaggerate or paint this, you know, overly vivid pictures, the whole issue that she was addressing really shocked the church back home. You know, the church back home is used to hearing victory stories about people getting saved, not cold, hard realities of what was really going on and all the, you know, all the dirt of what and all the issues that some of these missionaries were facing. And, you know, again, remember, too, 1903, we're still in the Victorian era. This stuff is so taboo, and I've talked to you guys about this before, but, you know, even just prostitutes back home in the UK, you know, nobody in society ever mentioned things like that. And remember, like I told you guys, the society women, they knew very well when their husbands were going out and sleeping with prostitutes, but that was not something anyone ever talked about. That was just like anathema. You don't mention that. You know that this is going on. You know these people are out there. And there was obviously child pornography and all kinds of stuff. Even back then, it was going on. But nobody ever talked about stuff like that. And so for Amy to write this book all about what was going on in India, this expose, it was just like, you know, again, if they weren't going to hear, didn't want to hear about it going on back home, why are they going to want to hear about it going on the mission field where you're supposed to have all these happy stories of what God is doing? And so... not well received. Yep, that's a good way to put it. So Amy was like, I mean, she was just ripped up and down, man. She was slandered, rebuked for bringing this to everyone's attention, like pretty hardcore. She's very much ahead of her time. So, but it's sad to see, you know, really what the church does sometimes to its own when somebody is unconventional, right? We can't really handle unconventional sometimes very well. she was not doing anything unbiblical, nothing, you know, I mean, she prayed through the entire thing, you know, there was nothing ungodly about what she was doing, but it was unconventional. It was not what this society wanted to hear.
I wonder if it would have made any difference if a man had written a book like that and exposed.
Maybe.
He wouldn't, though.
Yeah, they wouldn't, yeah, that's a good point, I don't think.
He also had a style of writing that was very unique. Very descriptive and very emotional.
So right. That's right, and bring that. Yeah, and they wouldn't want to, like you said. So, exactly. Well, especially like, yeah, a British man wouldn't. You know, they don't want to talk about stuff like that. So, I know. This is Victorian England, Victorian society. They were very much that way. They were very disciplined in their.
William Randolph Hearst in that Hearst Castle. Mm-hmm. You see pictures of his mistress. In when they show
they had a kid.
Wait, where are we going here, guys? Whoa, let's rope it back in. Somehow we just got to Hearst Castle. I don't know where. I was in India for a minute, but I don't know. Okay.
But I asked my mom years ago. I said, "Well, why do you always see this lady, but she isn't his wife?" And we don't talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't talk about mistresses. They didn't, it was just something they didn't talk about. And they were very disciplined in their social conduct. Like, they would not talk about stuff.
At the castle, if you tour there, she's still not, you see her in the movies, the things that they show of the castle,
yeah.
She's in them. And then you see the picture of his wife somewhere else.
Behind the door to the cellar somewhere. She's like... Right. Wow. Yeah. Well, see, yeah, again, in this early 1900s. Yeah, exactly. So, well, yeah, even here. So, again, it was not well received. But the Lord had already told her it wasn't going to be easy. She knew that. And so she said she must, I love this, she said she must go on loving, go on praying, go on forgiving, and watch for the comforts of God. You know? And I think that's awesome. She was okay with being misunderstood. And sometimes we need to be okay with being misunderstood. Like, that's, you know, that's all right. And I think I've quoted this poem to you guys before. I don't know if I have or not, but it came to my mind this afternoon when I was studying. What is it? It matters not if the world sees or hears or understands. The only applause we're meant to seek is that of nail-scarred hands. And I have no idea who wrote that, but it's so true. Isn't that good? I should just take credit for it, but I can't. I don't know who wrote it. But it's true, right? The only applause we're meant to seek is that of nail-scarred hands. That's where our identity is. That's where it comes from. It matters not if the world sees or hears or understands. The only applause we're meant to seek is that of nail-scarred hands. If you're doing it unto Jesus, that's very freeing, isn't it? Then, you know, you're just doing the best you can and doing what he's called you to do. And then at the end of the day, you can kind of wash your hands of it and be like, okay, Lord, I sought you today, and I wanted to please you, so That's, you know, there was a freedom in that. And I think that's what freed her to be able to say she could go on loving, praying, and forgiving, and just seek for the comforts of God, not the comforts of man, because that wasn't there, you know. So I know that's really ministered to me a lot. So it was actually during a period of criticism similar to this. She went through a lot of seasons of criticism, really. And you think, little sweet Amy Carmichael, you know, here she is. Oh, here's some more pictures of her. Look at her with little kids. I mean, come on. How do you not love a woman like that? But she went through a lot of slander and a lot of... Yeah, she was. She was a little peach. But she still faced, you know, again, criticism and slander and ridicule and all kinds of stuff. And it was actually during another period of criticism, like I said, similar to this, that she wrote this poem. No wound, no scar, yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow me. But thine are whole, can he have followed far who has no wound or scar? And here's another one, kind of similar on this train of thought. From prayer that asks that I may be sheltered from winds that beat on thee, from fearing when I should aspire, from faltering when I should climb higher, from silken self, O captain, free thy soldier who would follow thee. From subtle love of softening things, from easy choices and weakenings, not thus are spirits fortified, not this way went the crucified. From all that dims thy Calvary, O Lamb of God, deliver me. Give me the love that leads the way, the faith that nothing can dismay, the hope no disappointments tire, the passion that will burn like fire. Let me not sink to be a clod. Make me thy fuel, flame of God. That's kind of one of her famous lines. I don't know, that's sweet, man. I love that. There's that spirit that embraces sacrifice, right? Like, Lord, don't let me just hide away from anything that you are calling me to. That spirit of sacrifice, because she knew Christ's sacrifice for us, right? Remember, it's how we know God, is how we're going to live. And she knew God in that from the time she was a little girl. You know, she saw the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and that was what compelled her to live a life of sacrifice as well. And you even see that in her writings come out so very clearly. And it's not like, obviously, you guys know this, it's not like you go running after trials, like some sadistic weird, and like, oh, I just can't wait to go through another period of suffering, you know, but, you know, we don't want to hide from it either, you know, she was willing to embrace that, she wasn't like seeking after it, but if it came, she's like, Lord, if this is what you have for me, I will embrace what you call me to. So, this was all, again, you know, early 1900s here when this happened. And actually, in the year 1900, she and her little starry cluster, her little helpers, they moved from their home with the walkers to a little compound of buildings in Donavore in South India. And so as Amy was starting to get really heavily involved in exposing the temple prostitution, writing that book, all that other stuff's going on, she'd already taken little Prina in, and so she started to really have vision for a further ministry in this area. Like practical ministry, not just writing a book and exposing it, but how can I actually help these kids? And so she started to open up the Donavore Fellowship to any kids that could be rescued from such a terrible life. And so March of 1904, she got her first temple baby rescued by an Indian pastor. He brought the baby to her. Others soon followed. Gosh, just 2 years later, there were already 70 members of the Donavore Fellowship, and it doubled a few years later. And then January of 1918, a little kid was dropped off, which turned out to be a boy. And that was kind of funny because they didn't realize it until they went to change his diaper. They're like, oh, no, wait a minute. How did you get here? Because they didn't take boys. You know, they didn't know what to do. They're like, ah, how are we going to handle this? But then a few months later, another boy got dropped off, plus 100 pounds British sterling in order to build a boy's nursery. And so they were like, okay, Lord, you're providing funds. Obviously, this is a new avenue of the ministry. We weren't prepared for this, but we're willing to go for it. So this ministry to boys opened up as well. Because remember, there were also boys being forced into prostitution and temple service. So ugh, yucky, yucky stuff. 1926, there were 80 boys living in Donavore, and then loads and loads of girls, of course. And so as Amy kind of prayed and waited, the Lord soon provided men that would came in to kind of help take over that area of the ministry. In fact, you know, God provided in so many ways, and I didn't write down like loads and loads of stories. I probably should have. But, you know, there were several instances where God would just provide what was needed. And, you know, just more of those kinds of stories, right? Where at the last second, the Lord did this thing. At one point, for example, Amy felt it was time to build a nursery. But she had just been praying and didn't say anything because she wanted to wait for God to give her the green light to go on it. She's like, I'm going to just keep this to myself. I feel like we need a nursery, but I'm not going to go there right now. I'm not going to say anything to anybody. So she had barely told, so she finally felt like she could, like the Lord did give her the green light to tell her little Donovan family, her little helpers and stuff. And so she just told them, she's like, you know what, I think the Lord wants to build a nursery, but I know we don't have the funds for this yet, so we just need to start praying. But seriously, right after she told them, this check came, I think from back home in Britain, which had the exact amount of money they would need to pay for bricks in order to make, you know, to build it, the structure. And then soon after that, they got this another anonymous gift in the mail that had the words "for the nursery" written on it. And there was literally no way anyone could have known that this was what they needed, or that they didn't even have a nursery at the time, right? So that hadn't even been built yet. So, or that wasn't even in the plans. She hadn't told anyone back home. So this was totally a God thing. He just put it on somebody's heart that they were going to do a nursery and that he needed to send money. And so obviously the Lord orchestrated, and this happened to her all the time, you know, these kinds of stories. So just like George Mueller, there we go, Hudson Taylor. Yeah, all of these kinds of stories. So sweet, you know, when you step out in faith, you watch the Lord provide and come through. Again, remembering that we are emphasizing God's love in her life, not surprisingly, Amy, remember I said, like, after seeing what she'd seen in some of the missionaries, she decided, I want to make sure that love is my trademark, that I, you know, see everything as a chance to die to myself. And she wanted that to be the trademark of the fellowship in Donovan as well. She wanted it to be a place where she said the Lord himself would feel at home because they were living in literal obedience to his command to love one another. Because she said, hey, Jesus didn't give us a single command that he would not empower us to obey. And therefore, it is possible, you know, to love one another, even the most unlovely or difficult people. And so Donovan became an example of love to, you know, everybody who came. And this was the mentality that she had. She said, what I especially want to bring to you is this. Young children, all who do not know our Lord have only one way of knowing how loving he is. They look at us. If there be any flaw in our love, if we fail them at any point, we make it just so much harder for them to see, to know, to apprehend his love. Do not let us fail our children. Love through me, love of God. And I think that's a really good point, right? We make it harder for people to see Jesus when we're not walking in love. We make the vision of him more obscure and dimmed. And so that's it's just a good question to ask ourselves. Do people see the Lord more clearly or more dimly by our relationships with one another? And would he feel at home? You know, would he feel at home in our workplace, in our homes, in our friendships? And do we live as though we believe his commandments are doable? You know, that they really can be obeyed. One of her biographers said this. He said, the fellowship of Donovan consists of men and women who earnestly endeavor to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace and who do actually live together in joyful fellowship. But this love, this harmony is constantly under attack. There is not a moment when the adversary is not seeking to undermine it. It is God who makes men to be of one mind in a house, and they would cease to be of one mind if the members of his household cease to be in touch with him, which is very true. So, you know, another good exhortation not to be ignorant of the enemy's devices and stay in touch with the Lord, because if we really are, then the unity and the love towards one another is going to, it should be the byproduct if we are staying in touch with the Lord. John 17, one of the key things Jesus prayed for was unity, right? So it's very important to him, and they made sure it was a very important part of the Donovan Fellowship. Kind of like, you know, what William Carey had done in India with the Serampore, the mission at Serampore. You know, do everything you can to avoid having the unity disrupted there, you know, and being vigilant in that. We have to be vigilant in that kind of area. And so the work did have its ups and downs. It wasn't all sunshine and daisies once they got Donovan running with all of the kids coming in. I mean, there were all kinds of all kinds of spiritual warfare and other kinds of dynamics, a lot of things coming against Amy, as I've talked about. For example, in 1910 and 1911, there was this whole flood of lawsuits that were lodged against Amy and Donovan for taking the temple babies. And Amy dealt with lawsuits for years, man. It's kind of funny. You don't think of Christians as, like, you know, having to deal with stuff like that and getting sued all the time. Think, what is she doing wrong? But, you know, she was just, you know, she's just serving the Lord and doing what he called her to do. And so she's dealing with all of these kinds of lawsuits. At one point, she was almost thrown in prison on kidnapping charges. because she planned to make this 5-year-old girl disappear from her abusive guardians. And that's really what she was doing. They were going to just make her disappear, pretty much. And somebody found out about it, and so they called Amy in, and they were getting ready to arrest her and take her off to jail. And suddenly this telegram arrived that said, criminal case dismissed. That's it. That's all it said. There was no explanation. They never knew what happened, why the case was thrown out. Obviously, I think the Lord just did that for her. So, because he was always protecting and defending her. None of these lawsuits ever held water. I mean, she never ended up, like I said, in prison or anything. But she did have to deal with all of that, and it was difficult. You know, these are not easy things to work through. Reverend Walker died in 1912. That was a huge blow to Amy. He'd been such an important part of her life and ministry there. Other difficulties arose from time to time. World War I was a pretty difficult season. Anytime, obviously, those darn world wars, whenever they broke out, it just made life so difficult. So, Amy weathered the storm, and the work continued to grow, you know, pretty explosively, really, between 1920 and 1930. And then, in 1931, Amy was 64 years old, and she was visiting a village, and she fell into a pit. And her leg was broken. Okay, so that's one thing. You know, she getting her leg set and everything, and her leg healed. But because, remember, she was prone to neuritis, right, neuralgia, and then she started to experience arthritis as well. So she starts, all of those things that had been bugging her back in Japan and everything started to come back. All the nerve pain, all of the issues. And so she ended up entering, you know, she never really recovered from this whole fall into the pit and everything. She ended up living the rest of her life, the next 20 years, as a convalescent, basically as an invalid. And so, you know, and really a lot of the strain and stress of all her years in India without taking a break, they all kind of just piled up at this point and took their toll on her body. However, Amy never remained static or unproductive for a minute. She actually used this as an opportunity to minister through writing, okay? And remember, this is what Lilias Trotter did too, right, at the end of her life. Lilias Trotter was also an invalid. She was just a generation earlier than Amy. But this became like a major part of her ministry. In fact, it's kind of cool because the two of them were pen pals a little bit. They were friends through correspondence. They never met each other because, again, Lilias Trotter was a lot older. I think she died in 1920, right? I can't remember exactly. But they had communicated at one point. In fact, Lilias Trotter's last letter, one of her last letters was written to Amy Carmichael. So I thought that was kind of sweet. I know, it's kind of neat when you realize these people were contemporary with each other and stuff, and appreciate each other's ministries. You know, and they both were writers. They both wrote poetry and, you know, had that kind of mindset. And so Amy wrote 13 books during this time, 35 total in her lifetime, loads of poetry, some of which I've read, countless letters, newsletters, all of it, like, really obviously blessed, encouraged, inspired people back home. So this is where she became, I guess, everybody's favorite person again after that book had died down, or all the crazy drama with that. I mean, this is like 20, 30 years later now, so it's like, okay, everybody's over it. So it's actually probably because of her writings that Amy Carmichael has become such a famous and well-loved missionary. And it's interesting because I was thinking about this a lot today, and I'd never really considered this, but I really do think that the power of her writings, a lot of the power in her writings, I think, came from the suffering. Came from the fact that she was bedridden. You know, there's this book she wrote, and this is probably the book that's most ministered to me. It's called Rose from Briar. It's not one of her more well-known ones. Have you read that one? Yeah. Rose from Briar. And she talks a lot about, that's when she really goes into her illness and the suffering, and she's pretty real about it. I mean, she does write, you know, very, you know, she's still writing poems and talking about how wonderful God is and all that sort of thing, but she's also very real in some of it with, like, how rough that was. And she wrote this book for people with chronic illness. And so I don't know if it would mean the same thing to everybody, but it means a lot to me because I was engaged to a man with chronic illness. And so reading that book really, really spoke to me and really, really meant a lot and really validated a lot of things. And I just saw, you know, it was cool because some of the things I see with Amy Carmichael, that's what I saw, you know, being with Darren. I mean, I saw a lot of depth that comes from suffering, a lot of depth, a lot of beauty in a person's relationship with God. And he really made me want to, like, go all out for Jesus, like, seriously, because that was all he had was Jesus. And I see that with Amy Carmichael in her writings. You really see that kind of love for Jesus and clinging to him. and as the only one who really understood what she was going through. And so I think that's what brought so much depth to her writings was that. And so I'd never really thought about it before, but after reading Rose from Briar and walking through that a little bit myself with somebody, I could understand why it was so impacting and what's made her writing so fruitful to so many people over the years. So I encourage everybody to read her stuff. A lot of people think, oh, it's a girl, I don't want to read girl books, you know, maybe the guys or whatever. But honestly, she's not a fluffy, girly writer. I mean, some of it, you know, might be a little florid, and if you're not into poetry or whatever, that's fine. But dude, she writes some hardcore stuff, too. If you read If, I guarantee you will be convicted. Edges of His Ways, that's a great devotional. So, I mean, she's written a lot of really, really good stuff, and I highly recommend it. So the work continued to grow and expand. Amy was able to take care of a lot of the administration from her bed. India came to acknowledge a lot of her service to their country. By 1919, you know, as the years had gone by, they kind of realized, like, oh, Amy's actually been helping our country. And so they stopped with the lawsuits. By 1933, the work of Donavore was recognized all over the world. Temple prostitution was eventually abolished in India, as far as I know. I don't know if there's any still going on today, but yeah, maybe little interior villages, yeah. So, but generally speaking, you know, she was a huge force in bringing that about. Really cool. So, and yet, in spite of all of this, Amy never lost sight of that phrase that had been her motto years ago. Remember when she had the welcome in Belfast, that ministry there, that in all things he might have the preeminence. That was always her motto, and that was, you know, very true of her life. She said, "It may be that decisions which seem to change the character of the work will have to be made, but if the root principles which have governed us from the beginning are held fast, there will be no real change. The river may flow in a new channel, but it will be the same river. If you hold fast to the resolve that in all things Christ as Lord shall have the preeminence, if you keep his will, his glory, and his pleasure high above everything, and if you continue in his love, loving one another as he has loved you, all will be well, eternally well." So she slipped into a coma, and she passed away January of 1951, age 83. And again, like I said, her work lives on today, not just through her writings, but it's really cool because the ministry at Donavore is still going, too. And I actually, at one point, had this really cool documentary with where they showed Donavore and all the kids doing their activities. And they had interviews with some of her kids that were still alive. Not Prina, but some of the older ones, or the later ones. And they were getting up there, but they remembered Amma, and they talked about her and her later years and all of that sort of thing. It's really, really sweet to see. You know, 1 John 2:17, right? He who does the will of God abides forever. And that's what we see with her life and her ministry. It continued on even beyond her lifetime in a really sweet and powerful way. So part of the Donavore Fellowship's constitution said their purpose was to do anything that may be shown to be the will of our Heavenly Father in order to make his love known, especially to the people of India. And so, you know, really, Amy, as she knew and loved her God, she was able to make that love known, you know, to and through the Donavore Fellowship to all those around her. So I'm just going to close. I'm going to read one more poem because, again, it ties in with just the fact that love was such a key ingredient in her life. And then I'm going to read something from Elizabeth Elliot. "Love through me, love of God, there is no love in me. O fire of love, light thou the love that burns perpetually. Flow through me, peace of God, calm river flow until no wind can blow, no current stir, a ripple of self-will. Shine through me, joy of God. Make me like thy clear air that thou dost pour thy colors through as though it were not there. O blessed love of God, that all may taste and see how good there thou art, once more I pray, love through me, even me." And then Elizabeth Elliot said, "If it were possible to poll all the missionaries who have worked in all the world and all of Christian history, it would be seen that missionary work most of the time offers little that could be called glamour. What it does offer, as Amy wrote to prospective candidates in later years, is a chance to die. It offers a great deal of plodding and plowing, with now and then a little planting. It is the promise of rejoicing, of precious seed bearing fruit that gives heart. So it was with Amy. Her letters home are not triumphant accounts of people turning to God from idols, but little stories of one or two children in a village who were willing to learn a scripture verse, sing a little gospel song, an occasional dialogue with an educated Hindu, a schoolboy who seemed interested in the Bible, and then later stories about the children of her Donavore family. She finished her course, Amy Carmichael, one of the tens of thousands of lovers of the Lord who staked everything on his faithfulness. So let's pray. Lord, thank you for the life and testimony of Amy Carmichael. Lord, thank you for, pouring into her, Lord, so that she could pour out and be given, Lord, so we could be blessed even by her life and ministry to this day, Lord. And thank you that can be all of our legacy one way or another, Lord. And it's going to look different for each and every one of us, Lord, but we can all leave behind that fragrance, Lord, and that legacy of a life well lived for you, God, a life that is sacrificial, gives, Lord, serves others. Man, what better way to live, Lord, than to bear fruit that is eternal, God. And so I pray that you would do that in and through our lives, Lord, even as we continue on finishing out the week and into the weekend, Lord. As always, we pray for divine appointments and opportunities, Lord, where we could extend your love, Lord, where we could bear fruit that is eternal, God, by investing in the lives of those you put in our path, Lord, by being sensitive to your spirit and to your leading, wherever you would send us, whatever that might be, God. So whatever that looks like for us, God, we just ask that you would go with us, Lord. We acknowledge you and we trust that you are leading and guiding. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about, did Donavore, did they give the kids their education and then did they graduate?